School Finance Day, although towards the end, this tends to be, if we have a bill on the formula, this is of great interest to everyone. And one of the issues Steve Meyer has to go through, our economist on this, is people tend to just focus on the runs at the end, and the knowledge about the formula is really relegated to Senator Monroe, myself, and whoever else cares to delve into it. And that's as bad as, at least in the Senate or in the legislature, you don't get this broad swath of folks.
And Mr. Chair, Steve's been around forever. He remembers me from my previous service.
Steve, how long have you been with in legislative revenue?
Since 75.
Oh, my gosh.
Way back.
Beginning.
That was when
the office was formed.
Mm-hmm. Oh, really?
Yes. It was the Big Bang.
Holy smokes. You were, wow.
Right after Moses came down off the mountain.
Yeah. It's 19. Okay, well, in his 30th year with legislative revenue, past 30th year, our update on the school finance formula, Steve Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Steve Meyer, Legislative Revenue Office. I'll try to shorten it a bit this morning since we're starting late. And if there's areas that you want to pass over or speed up, that's fine. We're going to talk about the school finance formula and a little bit about what happened to your Sherwood School District. As you know, it's a fast-growing district. And so as we go through the material, you want to keep in mind, well, how does this part of the formula affect that kind of district?
Mm-hmm.
But you also want to generalize it, too, in terms of how it affects districts that perhaps aren't growing so fast or are actually declining. So we'll touch on some of that and maybe point up a few other differences that this district in particular varies from the state average. I've updated this just to give you an idea of the magnitude of what school finance covers. When you include all of the school districts together, we're over a half a million students now, and employing about 30,000 teachers and aides and over 20,000 support staff. And that support staff would be in any role, whether they're administrators, bus drivers, food staff, whatever. But broad coverage. We want to look at three levels of equity or fairness in the system this morning. And we'll start out talking about how does it divide it up between school districts and ESDs. That's the first division of the money available. And we're talking about both state school fund dollars and local dollars at this stage. And then once we look at that, we want to see, well, how is the school district portion divided up among all the school districts and ESD portion among all ESDs. So that'll be the focus this morning. If we start out with the state school fund, there's a certain amount of money that comes off of the top for special uses. And I have a list of those later to share with you. But once those are taken off, you have the state school fund left over that's available for distribution. You add to that both school and ESD local revenue to get a big total, statewide total number then for both school, for funding both school districts and ESDs to allocate among them. If you look at that big pot or cookie jar, it gets divided between school districts and ESDs with 95.25% going to school districts, 4.75% going to ESDs. So that's the first division that was adopted at the last legislative session.
So Senator Monroe, we took 0.25, you know.
Okay, yeah. Great. Yeah. Before that, session. It was 95.5.
Yeah.
And then if you want to get down to how much of the state school fund do school districts get relative to ESDs, then you have to subtract the local revenue of each. And then that will use up all of the state school fund. Okay, so if we look at what those shares are for both school districts and ESDs, property tax is about 30%, other local 3%, and the state school fund making up 67%. And that ratio hasn't changed a lot, but the state school fund portion was a little bit higher before the recession in 90 or 02, excuse me. It's dropped a little bit. But if the state school fund appropriation goes up as perhaps expected or proposed by the governor, that will probably start, that percentage, that 67% will start increasing again. All right, with that opening, then we want to turn to the formula itself. And just start out, I think I like to indicate what the formula is not about. It's not about anything dealing with cost reimbursement, or, well, there's components of cost reimbursement, but not general reimbursement. Mm-hmm. There's no revenue entitlement per student, nothing about adequacy, nothing about accountability or what the program has to be or what the quality of those programs have to be. All of this has come up as issues after the formula was adopted. In 91, the issue was property wealth and how much property wealth per student each district had and how to equalize that. So it's kind of a different discussion now, but we still have the same formula. It is about defining what school district equity is, or what's the measure of fairness among school districts. And it does that by measuring the relative need of districts given certain student and district characteristics, weeding, for example. And it does reflect the finance issues and court decisions of the 80s, again, going back to what was more of a property tax-funded system. And then there's been changes as legislative policy has refined the measure of equity over time since its adoption. Distribution principles. Actually, there were four primary principles that were taken into account when the formula was put together. One was to share all school funding statewide. Let districts decide how to spend their allocation so that basically it's a lump sum grant. No categorical grants, although the formula has grant components. And adjusting funding only for uncontrollable cost differences. If schools have the same cost per student, there's no need to differentiate. But you want to differentiate when there are specific costs that drive what revenue that the school district needs. And we'll list those differences. And then avoid incentives to increase district allocations. Basically, minimize districts being able to game the system to try to maximize their revenue from the formula. And you'll see this reflected in some of the details. The easiest way to look at the formula is, I think, this at a high level. State revenue plus local revenue equals the sum of four grants: general purpose grant, transportation grant, high cost disability, and facility grants. And you can look at each of them, we'll look at each of those separately and add some details to how that grant is calculated. But this is the overall high level statement of the formula without getting into the nitty gritty details. So if you can keep this in mind and kind of build on each of these grants, then I think that will help the understanding of the overall formula. Just a reminder that the state school fund doesn't all come from the general fund. A little bit of it comes from lottery revenue generally, although that can fluctuate from biennium to biennium. Here we have what the state school fund dollars are actually used for. Remember what comes off of the top. Small high schools in 2005-07 was $5 million.
Is that sunsetted? The small high school?
No.
No sunset at all. No.
I don't believe so. I think the sunset was taken out last session. State special education for students that are in hospitals, long-term care, deaf-blind schools. And then last session, there was $2 million set aside for implementing the virtual school program for the Department of Education.
Is that a permanent $2 million?
No.
Just one time?
One time, unless it's renewed.
Okay.
And then the rest for schools and ESDs. Local formula revenue that's included in the formula are from these specific sources: operating property taxes collected, not what's imposed, so that it's a mixture of what's collected from prior years as well as the current year. The common school fund money, county school fund money, federal force revenue. Just for your information, for the local revenue dollars that we're including in the formula, we currently have federal force dollars at zero. We're not assuming that there will be federal force dollars in 07-09 at this time. So once we get some response from Congress, if there is any, then that will be added. Would be an increase to the overall total. State managed county trust force, ESD local revenue. When ESD equalization was adopted, it was clear that some ESDs would have more local revenue than what the formula for ESDs said they should have. And for some ESDs, it was quite a bit. So the decision was, well, if they have more local revenue than what the allocation says they should have, then they have to distribute that excess back to their component school districts. And the component school districts then have to include that in their local revenue. And then any revenue in lieu of property taxes, which is very minor. You can see the relative proportions in this chart, property taxes being a little over 91%, federal force about 2.7%, at least in 05-07, may go to zero. Common school fund close to 4%, and all other little over 2%. All right, back to the formula. Now, we've talked about state revenue. We've looked at the local revenue sources. Let's start in on the grants themselves. And we're going to work from right to left here and start out with the facility grant. But first, I wanted to list all of the cost factors that are included in the formula. These are the factors that deal with, and the only factors that deal with, cost differentiation between school districts. The weights, the teacher experience adjustment, transportation costs, and then the two grants that were added after 91, the high cost disability and new facility costs. So those are considered the important cost factors that differentiate the revenue need of one district relative to another. And those can change over time. It's a matter of, are these the most important? Should others be added? What's the relative importance of each? All right, facility grant equals up to 8% of construction costs. It's up to, because the law says you start out, well, what would 8% be of new construction costs for school districts? And then it compares that to what's available. The limit is $25 million per biennium. That was also increased last session from 17.5 million to 25.
Is that on a first-come, first-served basis, or?
No, everybody that opens a new school or whatever the classroom space is applies. They calculate what the 8% would be. Mm-hmm. They compare the total to the $25 million and then prorate it down so that everybody gets the same share, same percentage share of their cost.
Okay.
And it cannot be used for construction. It's set up for equipment and furnishings that go inside the building or the classroom structure.
So that's a dumb question. How do they project that? So they say, okay, we just built Century High School, or Hillsborough. Did y'all just press a bond?
Liberty.
Okay, so we just opened Liberty. How do we project what is going to be the cost of desks, computers, or whatever the...
Look, Mr. Chair, it's paid in the school year that the facility is first used.
First.
All right, so most of the costs are known by that time.
So they know how many desks, they know how many...
Mm-hmm. Well, no, the construction cost of the building that we're taking 8% of, that's in the contract, and whatever adjustments have to be made to that, to the construction process.
It's 8% of the building, but the money can only be spent for furnishings.
Correct.
I see. Huh. Okay. Somebody was smart that did that.
And the costs can be for new construction. It also applies to additions and portable classrooms. But it cannot include land costs. So if a school district is looking to the future and wants to buy some bare land anticipating of needing that land for constructing a school, that doesn't get included right away.
Huh.
Okay, that's the facility grant. Moving on to the high cost disability grant, relatively new. Again, it equals up to the sum of eligible costs above $30,000 per disability student. And again, this was $25,000 and was increased to $30,000 last session, primarily because the grant, this one also is limited to $12 million per year. Right? With a $25,000 threshold for costs, the eligible amount substantially exceeded $12 million per year. And it also included a lot of students between that $25,000 and $30,000 threshold level. So the decision was to, well, we'll reduce the number of students, reduce the number of administration dealing with those students by setting the threshold at $30,000 and then keep the $12 million grant, so that the percent of costs would rise from about 70% up to something, I'm not sure what it will be at $30,000. It was expected to be, you know, 90% or so, but I think it's going to end up being lower than that. School districts, I think, are getting better at identifying those costs. Hmm. So if the total adds up to more than $12 million, it's, again, prorated to keep it down within the limit. Transportation grant. This one has been around from the beginning. It was originally it was just 70% of approved transportation costs. Then it was allowed for some districts to be above 70%. And if you turn to the next one, you can see how those costs are arrived at. District transportation costs per student are calculated. The districts are then ranked from high to low cost. Right? The top 10% of those districts that have the highest cost per student get 90%. The next 10% get 80% of their costs included in the formula, and then the bottom 80% stayed at the 70% level.
And what? And if you could, do you know the chalkboard proposal on this?
It's a proposal to look at it and bring some costs in. But the question that I had is about the incentives. Doesn't this create a pretty poor incentive for school districts to rein in their costs if they know that the more they spend, the more they get back? They're in the top 10%.
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, that's a question that I can't answer. I assume that when the legislature adopted this, that they thought that 30% payment by the district, or that 30% that isn't included in the formula, would be enough of an incentive. That perception may have changed over time.
Mm-hmm. When's the last time? I don't think we've looked at it in at least the last 6 or 8 years I've been, and made this has gone. At least in my last 6 or 8 years, I don't know that the transportation grant has been. If it has, I don't recall it taking changes or proposed. I mean, we've had proposals, but.
Well, Mr. Chair, the only change that has occurred is this. The higher top 10,
that's
right. 10%. That's been the only change.
Mm-hmm. What biennium was that change?
It was 2 bienniums ago, if I was guessing.
No. Mr. Chair, it was in the 2001 session.
Yeah,
it
was 2001.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Senator Monroe.
So essentially the districts that would take advantage of that would be rural districts that are traveling long distances per child, more miles per child.
Mr. Chair, Senator Monroe, yes. The idea was that if a district is spending $500 per student for transportation costs, that 30% that's not included in the formula is a lot higher than for the district that's spending $200 per student. And so there should be some compensation for that difference that the district is responsible for.
So one of the bills we had in committee that I'm at least interested, it was last time, was some sort of block granting or a way to change the incentive process, Senator Starr mentioned, to hopefully maybe incent keeping your costs down, not running up this. There's no incentive not to. If I was a school district, that's exactly, I think, what I would do is just use every available dollar I can get in the transportation grant.
70%. Approximately equal to the percent of general fund money that goes to schools versus property tax money. Whereas back when Steve and I were much younger, and I was sitting there, Mr. Chair, I believe transportation got 50% at a time when state general fund was funding approximately a third. In those days, I remember people argued, you know, we're paying more to bus kids, a greater percentage to bus kids than we are to teach them. Money goes to the classroom. So actually what's happened since Measure 5 and 50 and so on, and where you've had a reversal of general fund versus property tax, a flip-flop, transportation, the 70% anyway, much closer approximates the amount of general fund going to transportation as also going to other classroom costs and other education costs.
That's interesting. Do you know, Steve, just off, this is a question I've had, is it a federal law or state law that mandates busing? We have in Beaverton where they'll bus a child a block. Actually, in my neighborhood, it occurs where people will take a bus a block, which to me just doesn't seem. I've always wondered if that's a if it's a state law.
So, Mr. Chair, that leads into this slide.
Okay.
At the state level, we have to provide transportation if the student is more than 1 mile away from the school, the elementary student more than a mile, and the secondary student if they're more than 1.5 miles away from the school. Federal law comes into play, I believe, with the students with disabilities that have to be transported basically door to door.
So the state law, well, there it is, a mile, or a mile and a half.
And local school districts can exceed, often do exceed that that 1 mile or 1.5 miles if the students to get to school have to cross major thoroughfares or there's other dangers. I know when I was on the David Douglas School Board for decades, sometimes we bused kids that were closer than 1 mile or 1.5 miles because it was found that it would be dangerous.
You have a big street or...
Four, six-lane boulevards they had to cross.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And it includes a few other items, like if they're busing between school sites for a class at another building, or and then the preschool handicapped students have to be bused. So. This just shows you how transportation costs have climbed over time and what the formula and non-formula shares are. Have increased as the number of students have increased, and probably as the number of suburbs and their distance sometimes from new school buildings changes. All right, so that's the three simple grants. Now we want to get into the general purpose grant, which is weighted students times a fixed amount, $4,500, but it is adjusted for a teacher experience factor, and then that total is balanced to available funds so that we still keep our equality between state school fund and local dollars equaling the sum of the four grants. The general purpose grant is where the balancing takes place, right? The other three grants, they're pretty fixed. The general purpose grant is the one that can go up or down to make the sum of the grants equal to the state and local dollars available. And we'll look then at each of these components. What you need to have a little background on is the student count, ADM being average daily membership with kindergarten at a half weight. And then ADMW indicates adding the weights to ADM. And then extended ADMW is the higher of the current year or the prior year ADMW. So a declining district will use the prior year ADMW, and a growing district will use the current year ADMW for their extended measure. Right, the weights that are used, the IEP, Individual Education Program for disability students, an extra one weight for a total of two, poverty an extra one quarter weight, English as a second language, or ELL, English language learners, that's used at the federal level now, an extra one half, pregnant and parenting, an extra one, and then neglected and delinquent students in foster homes, each an extra quarter.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Senator Monroe.
Definition of poverty?
census definition. And so there's a census count of students or the members of families in poverty this year.
Would that be the same as those defined as qualifying for free or reduced lunches?
Mr. Chair, Senator Monroe, no. That would be different. This is just the annual, every 10-year federal census data is used, and then it's adjusted for the years between the census dates by growth in number of students.
So this would be the federal poverty line that says for a family of four, you have to have, what, 19,000 income or something. If you're below that, you get the extra
Correct.
Quarter. Okay.
Yes.
How about neglected and delinquent?
That is a number that comes from Human Services. They have some, but I don't know the details or what the criteria is. But the students in foster homes, neglected and delinquent, come from Human Services.
You just wonder where all these categories. I mean, it seems like you pick them up by the time you've done students in poverty, pregnant and parenting, neglected and delinquent, and students in foster homes. I mean, you're trying to get at the same pool of kids that would have, I would think, just some special needs, and to give them a quarter weight every single time, are you hitting the same kid over and over in a quarter?
Not to exceed two, though. They can never get above two.
So once they hit, they get their quarter.
Yeah, if they're in poverty and delinquent and in a foster home and also pregnant, they still can't get above two.
Mm-hmm. They tap out or max out at two.
Mr. Chair, let me clarify between weights that are identified with an individual student and weights that are, in effect, applied to a group of students without the members of the group being identified.
Okay. Say that again.
The IEP and the ESL uh-huh. weights are attached to or identified by student.
Okay. IEP.
All right. And ESL.
ESL.
Right. The others are weights applied to a group of students without identifying what students are in that group. Right. Think about the census count.
Right. So you would just say David Douglas, 100.
Right. Without identifying which 100 students in Davis Douglas
they
are in the poverty count.
Just 100.
Yes.
Gotcha.
So the group counts don't apply towards that limit. Because
you can get over two.
You haven't identified an individual student.
So in essence, you can get above two then.
You can't, no.
You can't.
No.
Not for an individual student, but the application of it could have the effect of
the application, if that student is in some of the group counts, then it could.
Yeah. Okay. Good clarification.
We do have some information now about the IEP and ESL in terms of comparing what the weight dollars generated and the cost that districts report for those students. During the interim, I worked on two reports to look at that and basically confirming what the general reports have been from the districts. For IEP students, they make up about 13.3% of ADM. But again, we have that limit in the statute that says initially you can't count more than 11% of your students in this category. Again, one of those limits to minimize gaming the system. So it's limited to 11% without a waiver. Only 25 of the 197 districts fall below that 11%. The 167 are above 11%. So the vast majority exceed that because the state average is around 13. But the waiver process approves about 4,500 more students for the weight. So if you combine those under the 11% plus those that are approved above the 11%, you're covering about 89% of the IEP students with the extra one weight.
Sure.
Similar.
Is that because some districts might define who needs to go on an IEP a little more broadly so as to include more students in that category? Is that why you have that waiver process above 11%?
Mr. Chair,
to try and equalize things across the board?
The distribution of IEP students can vary substantially from district to district.
Yes.
Okay. And the distribution of the students that are high cost versus lower cost is also uneven among districts.
Yes.
Okay. And so the waiver was to try to compensate for that, but still compensate for it within certain restrictions, not leave it wide open. But the Department of Education has some criteria that they apply that was developed by a review committee to basically say, well, this district should get this many more students waivered, and this district shouldn't maybe get as many or any.
I think that's a yes.
So that criteria has been developed and is applied, and yes. Districts are ranked to come up with that. The other thing was that about half of the districts report IEP costs less than their IEP revenue. Okay. And I included federal and ESD dollars in that calculation. What I found was that those districts that have revenue slightly above their costs, that gap is really small. But for districts that have costs above their weight-generated revenue, the gap can be very large. Okay. So it's an uneven distribution between those that have revenue above versus those that have revenue below their reported costs. Similar information for English as a second language for the one-half weight. 124 districts report these students. They're about 11% of ADM. Again, reported costs average about $1,500 per student, but the formula weight revenue is about $2,600 per student. And only 12 districts reported costs more than the weight-generated revenue. So this is a weight then that tends to generate more revenue than at least what the school districts are reported to spend on English as a second language.
Gotcha.
This just gives you an idea of the count of number of students. The largest category is just for numbers of students is poverty, followed by special education and English as a second language.
Why don't we get rid of the neglected and delinquent category? I know you can't. you can't. That was in the big 1992 do it all.
Mr. Chair, the only response I can give to why it might be there is because it's probably important to some of the larger urban districts in 91.
That's where I'm from. Still not. I mean, it seems like you picked them up. We can return to... I'll keep asking questions about why that got there.
This just gives you an idea of the dollars generated. Level is a little over $5,000 for one weight, then special education dollars attached to that student is going to be a little over $10,000 and so on, just to give you the relative magnitude in dollar terms rather than student counts. There's also a few other weights. I won't really go into these, dealing with grades in schools, other than we've talked about kindergarten. There are weights for remote small elementary schools and small high schools. Won't go into that in any detail, other than basically to note that, yes, that adds to the weighted student total. And this gives you an idea of how much added weight that is relative to the size of the school. So here you have four grades for small high school. At 350, you have to be smaller than that, basically, to qualify as a small high school. And at each of the student levels, you can go up and look at the weighted ADM added in the darker portion between the two lines.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
any high school less than 350 students is considered a small high school?
It also has to be in a small school district.
Okay. And we have the qualifications here. Has to have, be in a district under 8,500 ADMW. It has to be in the same location as it was in 1995. It had to be in existence in 99. And then if it has fewer than four grades, that student count goes down to 267.
That covers an awful lot of high schools.
Yeah. So how many fall into this category? Do you know offhand?
I don't have that count with me.
Can we get at least get an amendment drafted that sunsets this?
It adds a little over 9,000 weights. How many schools that is, I don't have. But that's
9,000 weights are added. So
yes, that's both high school and elementary.
What's the? Well, I don't know. I would imagine that there's a very high percentage of Oregon high schools that have less than 350 students.
Which, I don't know.
I mean, and not necessarily. I thought this program was for extreme rural areas where they had, a small high school that they had to maintain because otherwise students would have to travel hundreds of miles to get to a bigger school, but 350, I'm shocked at that number.
You have to look at them in combination. But there are a lot of school districts that have under 8,500 ADMW.
Mm-hmm. So, Steve, when we the next time we schedule, and not to, we can continue, but when we schedule a bill around, and Paul was just pointing out there's a couple of them, around school finance or the formula, can we look into this a little more of how many high schools fall into that? Maybe that's a good time to at least consider an amendment that would put some sort of sunset on, so it's just not, in my opinion, into a permanent change.
That needs to be reviewed. It really, because I'll bet you like Corbett High School, which is in the Portland metropolitan area, I'll bet you falls under that. I guarantee it does. And there's others that are in urban areas,
mm-hmm.
That would fall into that. It's not just for the small rural. I definitely think we need to review it, sunset it, and then review it. It probably has purpose, but I think it needs to be redefined.
Mr. Chair, if it's a high school that's losing students, for example, it might have fallen outside. Now it's under, but it won't qualify because it wasn't a small high school in 1999.
Yeah, so I guess the question is how many existed as small high schools in 99?
Correct.
So we know how big the pool is. But the tell me if I'm wrong here, but we're allocating $5 million every single biennium, no matter that. To me, that argues for at least a review of the program, because you're right now, if nothing changes, we're just going to plop down $5 million to whoever is in that pool, no matter what.
Mr. Chair, that $5 million is outside the formula. We're talking about weights in the formula here.
So, it's, but we do.
But it's the same group of schools.
So we start July 1st, $5 million, boom, to these
off the top.
Off the top.
For the biennium. Yes.
For the biennium, and then after we're done with that, then we get into this.
How many weights are included in the formula for those high schools?
Yeah. So. I'd like to look more at that. I know we don't have time today, and won't surprise you, but look more at. I just to have that in permanent statute. To me, we don't know what the state of Oregon's going to look like in 10 years or 5 years. I know several factors go into why the formula is the way that it is, and
then you have. Similar qualifications for small elementary schools.
So mm-hmm.
May want to do that at the same time.
Yep. Yeah, if I remember this.
Okay, going on to student counts, this just compares ADM to ADMW extended. You can see how it's grown over time. The point here is that ADMW extended is about 20 to 25% higher than ADM, depending upon the year. Right. So if you want to look at dollars per student and you want it to be higher,
you use ADM. If you want it to be lower, you use ADMW extended. But consistently for the formula, it's ADMW extended. And so that's what helps make the dollars per student a little bit lower for one major than you will see for another major. Another cost factor, the teacher experience adjustment, compares the district average teacher experience in number of years to the state average, takes the difference and multiplies it by $25, and then that gets added to that $4,500 in the general purpose grant calculation.
That's an advantage for declining districts, because declining districts don't hire new teachers, or not nearly as many. The teachers over time tend to become older and more experienced. So that would be an advantage to declining districts like Portland District Number 1.
Yeah, that's older, yeah.
Be a disadvantage to fast-growing districts like Sherwood.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Yes, Mr.
Sherwood comes up empty on just every single one of...
That was one of the things that stuck out to me for Sherwood, is that it's about 3 years below the state average. So it's getting roughly $75 less per weighted student because of this factor. Okay, going back to then the general purpose grant equals extended ADMW times that $4,500 target increase or decrease by the teacher experience factor. The additions for teacher experience factor are offset by the districts that are below the average, so that overall the dollars are canceled out. It's just a matter of which districts they're going to. And then times the balance ratio to make the two sides of the equation equal. The $4,500 target has remained the same since 91. At the time that was a target, the funding was below $4,500, and the intent was to get up to $4,500 per weighted student. But we're much beyond that now, because the balance ratio is roughly 1.2. So that $4,500 basically is being increased about 20%.
And so what is the rationale for the teaching, Senator Monroe, you might know better, the rationale for extra dollars for teacher experience?
It's just what I said. It's to favor school districts that have declining enrollment and that have an aging
workforce.
And, you know, the one in our area that I think of is Portland District Number 1.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure they have the greatest benefit from this factor, probably of any school district in the state.
Yeah. Ryan?
Yeah.
Senator Decker, it seems to me that teachers that have been around a long time cost a lot more than teachers that haven't. So that's part of this whole situation as well. I mean, when you're at the top of your scale, plus you've got, you know, the extra... you know, degrees or education, you know, they just cost more than starting teachers, and I think that's part of it as well.
Help offset that.
And part of the problem, frankly, is, and I've been on both sides of teacher negotiations. I was a young teacher leader, OEA leader, negotiating for the teachers, and then I became a school board member negotiating for the school board. And what happens in teacher negotiations is it's the veteran teachers that get appointed or elected to the negotiations team. And they always argue for a higher maximum salary versus starting salary. And so you'll find that in most districts, the maximum salary is double or maybe even more than double the starting salary. I'm not sure you get double the performance from a veteran teacher that you get from a starting teacher. You should get some significant improvement, but, you know, when I did the negotiating for David Douglas, I argued for increasing starting teacher salaries. And so David Douglas in the Portland metro area still today has the highest starting teacher salaries of any district.
This is when you were
on the board. I had to battle the veteran teachers to get an increase in starting teacher salaries. I felt like we could hire the cream of the crop each year that way. And we were a growth district, so we were hiring a lot of new teachers. And I think it's been a real advantage to that particular school district. But it is endemic in the process of negotiations, the way it works, because you always get the veteran teachers that are on the negotiations team, and they're always arguing to get that top number up higher versus where you start the beginning teachers.
That's interesting. David Douglas is a really highly regarded district.
I had a little bit to do with that in my 10 years on that board.
I think that Senator Monroe is arguing for a position on the negotiating team for that statewide salary schedule.
Is there a bill? Governor Kitzhaber, I think, introduced a bill years and years ago. Haven't seen one since.
Mr. Chair, there is a bill that deals with the teacher experience.
Is there?
Yes.
Senate bill?
No. It's in House Revenue, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
But you may see it.
May is the operative word. Sorry, Steve, we just kind of... This is pretty interesting.
That's all right. Okay, so this then just restates the formula with the detail for each of the grants that we have looked at. So you have the general purpose grant being the upper left-hand corner, transportation, et cetera. What I would like to do now is just take a couple of minutes to say, since we have it in this format now, is to say what if we make a change, what happens, right? To see how the formula handles that. Let's assume that local revenue goes up in one district because of a new power plant that's built in the district that isn't exempt from property taxes. So that one district's local revenue goes up. What happens? Well, there's more local revenue statewide. State school fund revenue is the same. So how does that additional local revenue get distributed on the equal side? Transportation costs haven't changed, so that 70% hasn't changed. High cost disability is capped out, so it doesn't change. Construction costs are capped out, they don't change. So all of that additional local revenue goes into the general purpose grant calculation. The balance ratio increases a little bit. So that the district with the new power plant gets a little bit more money, but it has a lot more property taxes. So that district is going to get a lot less state school fund dollars. Those state school fund dollars that district gives up goes to all of the other districts. So again, that's sharing that resource, that revenue from that new power plant statewide. So that's the concept. That's how this formula works, equalizing statewide. So it's not what happens in one school district that's so important, but it is important to the state as a whole for all the school districts.
The same is true in the reverse when you lose the county to that forest plant, federal forest plant. Correct.
Correct. Yes. It will be just the reverse. Those districts, if they lose their federal force dollars, will get more state school fund dollars to compensate for that. Those state school fund dollars will come statewide. Every district will be affected.
Yeah, that's a very important point. That's why all of us, even those of us that represent counties that aren't going to lose, that don't have forest money, need to be fighting and working with our congressional delegation to try and get that restored.
The other thing, just one other one here, I suppose. What if a school district decides to build a new high school that's a Taj Mahal? Right. Does that affect all school districts? Right. There are 8% of construction costs that's just going to go way up. What does that do, though? You have a cap so that no more dollars are going to go to the facility grant. It's just going to rearrange the dollars that fall underneath that cap among the districts that qualify for a facility grant.
So the answer is yes, though.
It affects other districts, but not all districts.
The ones that are building.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we have to make that distinction.
But it's only 8%, so there's not the incentive to build at Taj Mahal is not there.
No.
Based on the 8%.
No.
So the 8%, instead of dropping to maybe 7.2, might drop down to 6 point something.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
And the same is for disability students because of the cap. Transportation costs, if they go up substantially, the 70% grant increases, where does the money come from? It can't come from facilities, it can't come from high cost, it comes from the general purpose dollars. Any other scenarios you would like to try out?
Well, anything we can do to reduce or make transportation more efficient for school districts benefits all districts.
Mr. Chair, Representative Monroe, I don't have an answer for that.
It wasn't a question.
Steve's always so like limited to Senator Morelick of what... Yes, Senator Stark.
Talk a little bit about what has happened over the last couple biennium due to, maybe it was just the last biennium, due to the loss of experienced teachers who have looked at what's happened with PERS and decided that it was important, it was time for them to retire. Has there been any significant shifts between districts as far as the formula due to that? Or has that just been pretty much equal throughout the state? Not.
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, I haven't looked at that in detail. Basically, the question would be how that has affected their teacher experience average years of. When the district is giving old, more experienced teachers an incentive to retire and hiring less experienced teachers to replace them, that the only way it basically affects the formula is through the teacher experience factor.
And it's likely that has been kind of maybe uniform throughout the state. So my speculation would be that it would probably be maybe neutral across the district. So nobody's really won or lost, perhaps.
I can't really tell how widely that's distributed among the districts. But the incentive for doing that is that the cost savings for the less experienced teacher more than offsets any lost revenue due to the teacher experience factor in the formula.
That's true.
A formula revenue, just to give you an idea of the shares by grant, the general purpose grant, over 95% of the total. Transportation, 4%. Facility grant, about 2/10. And high cost disability, about 3/10. Now, the transportation total is relatively small, so you have to think about whatever cost savings that you can generate in the transportation grant isn't going to be a large portion of the total picture.
So 4% of $6 billion is still a lot of money.
Yes.
Yeah, we spend so much time debating this 4.5%, not a lot on 95.5%.
Hey, just a quick look at the payment schedule. Districts get 2 months' worth in July, or double monthly payment in July, a regular monthly payment through May, and then no payment in June. Okay, formula results. Dollars have changed over time. There's been 3 years when the current year was less than the prior year, but the more two recent ones were 02, 03, and 04, 05. The boxes at the top that are just white with a black outline are dollars above the formula, but they were considered part of the school funding package at the time.
Was it lottery bonds?
Yes.
Okay.
Except for 97, 98, that was classroom needs, that was not lottery funded. And then in 01, 02, that's when the program was called the School Improvement Fund, and that wasn't lottery dollars.
You should put a little caption on there. Randall elected to the legislature, Randall moves on to treasurer's office. No more white boxes.
Exactly right. Yeah.
Okay. I say that with the greatest degree of affection. I voted for all of them.
Of course.
And then converting those formula revenue dollars on a per student basis, again following the same pattern over time. This is a slide that gives you, I think, a very good visual of what's happened since 91 with the adoption of the formula and its implementation. If you take the revenue per student of the districts in 91-92 and rank the districts accordingly, you get the line that goes from about $3,000 to above $5,000. And these are only the districts that have ADM above 500 students. If you included all of the small students in that 91-92 line, it would go up to $6,000 or $8,000. And they were left out just to make the chart a little bit bigger. Then if you compare that to the 03-04 revenue per weighted student, you have almost a horizontal line, but with some variation because of the differences in cost factors that aren't on a per weighted student basis, the transportation, the facility, the high cost disability. So the formula basically has accomplished variation in the hundreds of dollars per weighted student, whereas under the old system we were in thousands of dollars per weighted student variation from district to district. That's it for school districts. Mr. Chair, I don't know when you want to stop this morning.
Let's can we skip ESDs?
And I didn't really intend to cover the Education Stability Fund. That will be covered elsewhere. And the governor's budget numbers are there.
You want to do local option?
Your information.
The local option property tax, which can we do that section? And maybe if we have time, we'll hit a little bit of the ESD since I got a shrug on to my right on the.
Or you can wait until there's a bill on that topic and then.
Yeah, we'll have something on the ESD and we'll include that. I mean, I definitely want to come back to that when we schedule these two bills around school finance, do a little bit more on that whole conversation about high school and remote. So we can do that, and if we have one on ESDs, I don't know anything that's really hopping around ESDs, but we can certainly schedule a quick overview. Can we do the local option property tax real quick and
sure.
Look at the governor's budget?
If you'll skip ahead then to about slide 64, if you can see the numbers underneath.
Mm-hmm.
This was passed in 1999, House Bill 2753. The local option, school districts can raise all the local revenue they want that the local option allows, or that they have a gap for, right, between Measure 5 and Measure 50. There's no incentive to do more than the limits here, because if they exceed those limits, then that local option revenue becomes formula local revenue. So that was the way to keep a cap on how much each district could go for a local option. And again, it's disequalizing in the term of some districts have it, some districts don't have a local option. So that the idea was, well, all right, they can have it, but we'll limit how much they can, how much they have an incentive to raise.
Mm-hmm.
Because if they raise more, it doesn't really benefit them because it's going to go into their formula revenue.
Which no district's done that, I would assume.
No, not yet.
Very generous district if they do that.
Yeah, I would say so.
The limits are the lesser of the three there. The 15% of formula revenue are $750 per student times number of students. This is just a simple example. If the gap allows it, then the $750 is probably the next limiting, because the formula revenue has raised enough so that 15% of that is more than $750. In terms of elections, you see a history here of the local option elections, the passage rate,
has been about 38%, the failure rate 62%, so it hasn't been a real popular way to get additional local revenue for school districts. The limit is, well, it depends upon what kind of local option it is, but some districts have had a local option for 5 years. They've gone through that. They've gone back to the voters. They may have gotten approval for another 5 years. So each of these elections isn't necessarily a different school district. Some districts have had more than one election, so that district would be counted twice in this.
Yeah, I would assume that it's the same districts over, or many of the same districts over and over, repassing their local options that are in the pass column.
Local option equalization, it's basically, again, a way to try to equalize the local option revenue that the district can raise if it has a tax rate, the same tax rate as another school district for a local option. Two school districts have a dollar local option rate each. That $1 will raise more per student in one district than another district. Mm-hmm. So there's this calculation here to help equalize those dollars. Okay. And the equalized value is the assessed value per student at the 75th percentile district. Most of the districts that have local options don't qualify because they are above that 75th percentile in assessed value per district. So there's only a handful of districts that qualify for the local option equalization dollars. And it's about $400,000 is the initial estimate for this biennium, for 07-09.
$400,000 this biennium we're going to
be. That will go to just a few districts, a handful.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator.
Well, the local option has always been something that troubled me because, you know, there's such a disparity in property tax value per pupil across the state, and really the poorer districts, like David Douglas, which is one of the lowest in property tax value per pupil, have no chance at all of passing a local option. They're lucky if they can get a bond through to build a new school. Mm-hmm. I have trouble doing that. And yet, some districts that are very high value per pupil, like Portland District Number 1, can routinely pass local option and end up, you know, obviously with a lot more dollars to educate their students. Seems to me we ought to be, our goal ought to be to give every student in the state an equal opportunity at a quality education. I don't think this system does that.
Mm-hmm. No, yeah. Reynolds was talking to the superintendents from the Multnomah County, and they were all saying the same thing. Mm-hmm. That it's a tale of two worlds just within our own county.
Right.
In terms of.
Very much so.
Yeah.
Okay, and the rest then, if you want more detail about the $6 billion state school fund budget proposal in terms of how it's shared between school districts and ESDs and which years, you can look at the numbers on the slides at the end. And then the last slide is just a list of potential formula issues that you may be dealing with this session.
It's a good segue for you to just tell us to have fun with those, dealing with those formula issues.
And that's it. Good.
So, Steve, just before we wrap up, any words of wisdom? You have dealt with the formula more and seen people pass through these chairs left and right who come in and want to do this or that, and you heard kind of all of our points that at least issues we'll bring up, may bring up this session around what you heard on all the, whether it's transportation or the remote, the small high school. Any words of wisdom to us as you've watched legislators work on the formula and have success and frustration? And
Mr. Chair, I have nothing that I want to share publicly.
Oh, he retires.
Wow.
He's learned a few things in 30 years.
I couldn't even coax out of him, you know, it's difficult, or there's winners and losers.
What we should do is get a few old revenue chairs to come through here. Tom Bryan, Adelma Jones, and Ken Strobeck.
That's true. That's true.
They might be a little more willing to.
It's a good thing.
Those guys are all in the middle of that whole conversation.
I think.
In the 90s, it was like.
Well, Adelma Jones, I think, was the chair at the time that formula was created.
Oh, was she really? I didn't know that.
Yeah. I was vice chair in 77 when he was a lot younger. Earl Blumenauer was the chair of the House Revenue Committee.
And you were in the
and
Senate?
And I was chair of the Senate Revenue Committee from 85 to 89.
Huh. Mr. Chair, I think the issue of winners and losers has contributed greatly to minimizing the number of changes that have been made to the formula.
Yeah, but you have to, at the end of the day, you're going to have to take a look. Well, so we'll get to see you again, because I'm sure we will be like every other legislature that at least, and we have made, I mean, I would think relatively minor, I wouldn't call them major, or maybe in the medium range changes, what these last two sessions are on high cost disability. I feel certain the transportation issue is going to come up. So we get to work with you again. And on the stability fund, tomorrow is our last overview session, so we will be done with overviews tomorrow. We'll do our one last experiment with the roundtable, and then next week we will come back to the Stability Fund, because at least as scheduled today, Monday we'll start in on a discussion of building the state's reserves and entertain a couple bills that have different pathways to do that starting Monday of next week. Steve, thanks for sticking with us this morning, and look forward to working with you this session. We're adjourned.